first, and that Canada can help us, or they can get in the way and they will face the consequences of it.
How could the tariffs affect us? Here's Gas Buddy's Patrick DeHaan.
Not only is this going to cause consumers probably pay more in the areas of anywhere from 5 to 25 cents a gallon and potentially more, but the also risks of retaliation are significant that could further drive up fuel prices for many Americans.
Former senior FBI officials are reacting with alarm to a reported purge of agents by the Trump administration. Retired FBI Assistant Director Frank Figliuzzi was on CBS's Face the Nation.
With regard to dismissing hundreds or thousands of special agents in the field who have touched January 6 cases or Trump-related cases, this makes America less safe.
In Panama today, Secretary of State Marco Rubio warned officials that the U.S. may take action if they don't make immediate changes to the operations of the Panama Canal. He says Panama has violated the terms of the treaty that gave it control of the canal. The Trump administration wants to freeze all foreign aid while it reviews what's being funded. On CBS's Face the Nation, House Foreign Affairs Committee Chairman Brian Mast said he supports moving foreign aid programs from the U.S. Agency for International Development.
I would be absolutely for, if that's the path we go down, removing USAID as a separate department and having it fall under one of the other parts of United States Department of State because of its failure.
And two senior security chiefs at USAID have been placed on leave for refusing to allow Elon Musk's government inspection teams access to classified materials. 50 sick and wounded Palestinian children passed through the Rafah border crossing yesterday. Here's reporter Linda Gradstein.
It is the first time that border between Gaza and Egypt was opened since Israel captured the crossing almost 9 months ago. Opening it is part of the first stage of the ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas that began last month.
This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
The Todd Albaugh Show.
The argument from my former party has been, it's not the guns, it's mental health. Well, no worries, folks. Governor Evers has got you covered. He introduced a plan to put millions of dollars into mental health, particularly for young kids. And the Republicans in the chamber did not clap. If you can't be for kids, then what the heck can you be for? Jeepers, criminy.
The Todd Albaugh Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
James here, host of Unlabeled, your 90s mixtape, every Sunday from 8 to 9 on WFHR. It's your weekly dose of music, nostalgia, and pop culture exclusively on locally grown radio.
For Civic Media News, I'm Savannah Tomei Olson. Wisconsin researchers are studying ways microbes can recycle wastewater into eco-friendly products. Here's Judith Ruiz Branch.
In the dairy industry, which produces billions of pounds of cheese per year, whey byproducts can be processed with microbes to create products like bioplastics. Declan Roche with Foremost Farms USA, a Wisconsin-based dairy cooperative, says the same idea could apply across industries.
A lot of waste is generated in the processing of any food item. I'm just talking dairy in this instance, but any plant that processes agricultural products generates waste.
Roche adds, overall, the profit is low, but the ultimate goal is to transform how more industries use their waste so it can be cycled back into production. Byproduct waste requires oxygen to break it down, so it can't be dumped into waterways without being pre-treated, or it could affect water quality and harm aquatic animals. Roche explains that's where microbes come in. A microbiologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Erica Majumder, says the idea is to help curb climate change.
We already have extracted so many materials from around the planet that I think it makes sense to reuse what we already have in circulation instead of just depositing things in landfills and digging stuff up.
They say innovations like these that can help to address global waste require scaling up to industrial levels where controlled environments can allow these processes to take place. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Savannah Tome Olson.
Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. Some light snow and flurries early. Otherwise, our skies will eventually turn partly cloudy with highs in the mid-40s. A west wind will develop. Snow moves back into the picture tonight, 1 to 2, perhaps 3 inches by dawn. Lows in the mid-20s. Currently 35 degrees.
Up North News with Pat Kreitlow.
Monday morning, we'll talk about the controversy over how test scores are rated in Wisconsin schools and connect the dots to neglect from the legislature.
Weekday mornings starting at 6. Locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. This is our weekly weekend review of all things law-related, justice-related, rule of law-related. A lot of focus upon the institutions of government, including in this edition of Amicus Law Review. Things related to the Department of Justice. Big changes internally and externally as the Trump appointees and Trump non-appointees, civil servants, change a lot inside the Department of Justice at Main Justice there on 9th and Constitution in Washington, D.C., but also around the nation as the president, as is his obligation of the Constitution, nominates, again with the appointment of the advice and consent of the Senate, the appointment of U.S. attorneys nationwide. That all happening in this transition period. Right down the street. Right down the street from the Department of Justice is the United States Supreme Court. We turn our attention now in this second hour of Amicus Law Review to that major institution in Washington, D.C. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this second hour of Amicus Law Review. We have talked a lot on this broadcast about the United States Supreme Court because it plays a major role, as you all well know, in who we are in America, making some major decisions about all kinds of things, privacy rights, education rights, environmental issues, agriculture, commerce, labor, you name it, the Supreme Court is involved in the issue. One of the issues, of course, which I encourage listeners to think about is whether or not the Supreme Court now making many of these decisions, and yes, indeed, they come up through litigation. They come in challenges in the courtrooms around our country through the federal and appellate courts, ultimately getting the Supreme Court. Question whether or not the policy focus on all of these major issues has now been taken over by the United States Supreme Court. Why? Because the other branch, just across the parking lot there on Capitol Hill, it's the Congress. Those are the people inside that wonderfully important building, the cornerstone of our entire democracy, the Capitol, the House of Representatives, the United States Senate, whether those people, the people we send there to decide policy for us, to make these critically important and, yes, difficult and challenging decisions, whether they're doing their jobs. And more as issues related to all kinds of things. Yes, indeed, involving immigration, indeed, involving the status of a president to uphold or not uphold the federal decisions of the Congress when it comes to spending and federal programs, all of those kinds of things ending up in our courts, including ultimately the Supreme Court, because more and more, and this has been the history, of course, in recent times, our Congress cannot and apparently does not decide these major issues. I would offer to you that as you read the Federalist Papers, as you think about the Constitution of our nation and even the Constitution of it with a small c, as we approach in a couple of years here, the 250th anniversary of our nation as we know it, whether or not our nation would be recognized by our founding fathers for the incredible amount of power that now exists inside the United States Supreme Court and, of course, at the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, and that is in the White House. We've talked a lot about that as well. In between those two buildings, of course, is the U.S. Department of Justice. That's a part of the executive branch. It is not an independent branch of government. It is inside the department. The Department of Justice is inside the executive branch. And it too, again, exercising on behalf of an extremely powerful president an awful lot of authority. The question we raise as students of civics in America in 2025 here in Wisconsin and throughout our nation is, where is our Congress? Now, plainly, they get a lot of attention. They get a lot of attention in terms of recent days confirming nominees. Yes, that's right. Or not confirming them. Doing oversight of various issues. The question is, when it comes to these big ticket items like policy issues having to do with immigration and commerce and labor, yes, and agriculture and all kinds of other things out there, civil rights, this Congress of recent times, this is the 119th Congress, has certainly not been as active in terms of major issues, and instead those falling to a president and presidents, plural, who issue executive orders in absence of congressional action. And yes, more and more to the Supreme Court that decides cases when the Congress is not deciding those as our representatives. So let's talk, as we often do, about the inventory right now before the Supreme Court. Right now, 65 cases pending as of this first weekend in February. 65 cases in which the United States Supreme Court has said, we'll take those cases, where they've granted what's called a writ of certiorari. We've talked about that a lot on this broadcast. That's the order, the writ. Four of nine members of the Supreme Court have got to say, yes, indeed. Let's take a look at that lower court case. Let's take a look at that case coming out of a Supreme Court of a state in America. Of that 65, here are the big ticket circuits. The Fifth Circuit, that's Texas and Louisiana and Alabama. Lots of focus on the Fifth Circuit these days. Undeniably the most conservative district in our nation. 14 of the 65 cases coming out of the Fifth Circuit, not surprisingly. Close second, Ninth Circuit, huge geographically, very different politically, to use the small p sense of that word. Five cases coming out of the Ninth Circuit, five cases coming out of the Second Circuit. That's basically New York and adjacent states as well. Lots of population there as well. Seven cases coming out of the Fourth Circuit, four coming out of the Sixth Circuit, four out of the Tenth Circuit, two coming out of our own circuit, the Seventh Circuit, all of those comprising the 65-case docket now in front of our United States Supreme Court. And as we have talked about ever since October 1 of 2024, that's the first day, the first Monday in the new term of the Supreme Court entertaining oral argument, these opportunities for the parties to come forward through their attorneys, through their lawyers, their representatives, and argue to the court orally, vocally, publicly in support of their positions. We've seen, of course, the sketches of those because cameras are not allowed in the federal courts. But we've also heard from the justices as they have sparred with the attorneys about the merits and demerits of the issues in front of them. And indeed, just in recent weeks, ever since Donald Trump has been the president, while much of our focus has, yes, been on the Department of Justice, and yes, even more so on all of these actions being undertaken with dizzying flurry coming out of the White House, the Supreme Court has also been busy. Supreme Court entertaining arguments on January 21 and January 22nd, four cases just in recent weeks that are important. We're going to talk about one of those in particular, but let me tell you about what the cases are, again, as a part of our continuing inventory. A case called FDA, Food and Drug Administration, versus R.J. Reynolds. That was decided the day after the inauguration, January 21st. It involves whether a company, sounds pretty wonky, very legal, a company may petition a court in a circuit outside of the company's primary market, that is, outside of it, places where it does principal business, if it can petition a court outside that company's primary market, another circuit, if another company located within that court's jurisdiction signs onto the petition. That's a lot there, and it's the kinds of things that lawyers love to discuss. The question is whether or not a manufacturer may file a petition for review in a circuit court where it neither resides nor has the principal place of business, having to do with jurisdiction and the capacity of particular courts to decide cases. That's FDA versus R.J. Reynolds. There's another case named McLaughlin Chiropractic Associates versus McKesson. It concerns whether a thing called the Hobbs Act
requires a U.S. District Court to accept the Federal Communications Legitimate Interpretation of something called the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, whether the Hobbs Act required the district court in this particular case to accept the FCC's legal interpretation of this law. And what does that sound like? That sounds like, yes, once again, the question of whether or not courts should defer to the legitimate, the appropriate, the experienced-based views of a federal agency. How many times have we talked about that issue? How often has that percolated up in the annals of not just this broadcast, but of many people across the country who bemoan the fact that we have now gotten rid of 40 years of tradition when it comes to judges deferring to expertise, deferring to intelligence, deferring to people who know what they're doing. This is another one of those cases. Whether or not a trial judge should look at the FCC and say, you know what, your interpretation of this Telephone Consumer Protection Act makes sense. We should follow it, absent it being totally ridiculous. The question, once again, whether or not the Hobbs Act requires that district court to follow what the lower court has decided when it comes to interpretation, the issue now being applied on a regular basis, and judges more and more feeling free in the wake of the drop kicking, the abandonment of what you recall as the Chevron deference, courts more and more deciding on their own because, according to the Chief Justice, they know best. They know best how these laws should be interpreted, as opposed to the experience-based and justice-based decisions of these agencies. Then there's another case. It was decided, or argued rather, on January 22nd. It's called Cunningham versus Cornell University. It concerns whether Cornell University, in its Retirement Plan Oversight Committee, violated the Employee Retirement Income Security Act. You know that as ERISA, as claimed by one of the employees there. Whether a plaintiff can state a claim by alleging that a plan fiduciary engaged in a transaction constituting a furnishing of goods and services, lots of wonky stuff involved in that as well, lots of things involving language under Section 1106 of Title 29 under, that's right, ERISA. It is nonetheless a big issue having to do with labor issues and ERISA in America. That was argued on the 22nd of January. And again, also on the same day, a major case having to do with law enforcement, a case called Barnes versus Felix, concerns whether the moment of threat doctrine, keep that in mind, the moment of threat doctrine should be applied to Fourth Amendment excessive force claims. Questions whether or not courts should apply this moment of threat doctrine when evaluating an excessive force claim under the 14th Amendment. The moment of threat doctrine in law enforcement refers to an inquiry that examines whether officers were in danger of their lives, in danger of their security, at the very moment of the threat that resulted in the officer's use of deadly force. Again, lots to unpack there. Or should that doctrine be abandoned in favor of a more broadly stated analysis of all the facts leading up to and surrounding that use of deadly force? Analysis exclusively focuses on the moment just before the alleged excessive force was used. And so, on the 22nd of January, our Supreme Court entertained argument on exactly that issue. As Amicus Law Review comes back, I'll tell you what the justices seem to be inclined to do when it comes to these excessive force lawsuits and this interesting moment of threat doctrine, which is now before our United States Supreme Court. That as our broadcast continues.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR.
Today's job market is full of demand for skilled trade workers. Electricians, welders, mechanics, these and other trades are the backbone of every community. They're also a huge part in making sure the Army National Guard is always fulfilling its mission of service to our country and communities. Soldiers train to keep the power flowing, engines running, and supplies moving. The skilled trades these soldiers perform are the same ones needed in today's civilian workforce. Army National Guard soldiers are on the fast track to learning skills that can set them up for success at home with companies looking to hire the best. With options from plumber to helicopter mechanic and everything in between, soldiers are able to select the trades that best fit their lives. Their resumes are being built through their paid training and part-time service. Find out how you too can learn a trade profession and serve your community and country by visiting NationalGuard.com. Sponsored by the Wisconsin Army National Guard. Aired by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association and this station.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Hilario. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host for these remaining minutes, this remaining hour of our broadcast here on the stations of Civic Media, talking necessarily, as we need to do to understand what our government is doing, what our Supreme Court is doing routinely, talking about the recent cases in front of the United States Supreme Court, some of them the kinds of things that lawyers love to talk about, in the weeds, interpreting things like the Hobbs Act and, yes, other issues like ERISA. Nonetheless, very important for all kinds of people in America. You don't always need to understand the ins and outs of all these things, but it underscores the breadth of the kinds of things that our Supreme Court is taking on in right now, these 65 cases pending in front of it, including this issue having to do with the issue of moment of threat, a doctrine, again, that I suspect that many of us have not thought about a lot. All of this started in this particular case on an April afternoon, way back in 2016, when Ashtian Barnes, who's 24 years old, was driving on a highway outside of Houston, Texas, in a car that his girlfriend had rented. He was on his way to pick up her daughter from daycare. That's the premise for the case as it plays out. Although Ashtian Barnes did not know it, the car's license plate that his girlfriend had rented was linked to some unpaid tolls that had been incurred by another driver of that same vehicle. So what happens is there's an officer, his name is Roberto Felix Jr., of the Harris County Constable's Office, pulls the car over based upon those unpaid tolls that are attached to this particular car. Again, Mr. Barnes knows nothing about this because, plainly, the circumstances under which it's rented, he is driving the car. Barnes could not immediately locate his license once Roberto Felix approaches him, and he could also not locate the car's registration. And so the officer asks him to step outside of the car. And instead, Mr. Barnes, Ashtian Barnes, began to pull away. That's his action. He begins to pull away and not do what the officer directed him to do. Probably would have resulted in a very different result had he followed those directions and explained what is going on here. Instead, Ashtian Barnes began to pull away with the car door still open. And here's when the tragedy gets even worse. This is human tragedy of the highest nature, undeniably. Officer Roberto Felix draws his gun. He jumps onto the moving car's door sill and twice shoots Ashtian Barnes. And all this is recorded on the dash cam footage. The mother of Ashtian Barnes, her name is Janice Hughes Barnes, sued. And she says that the officer's use of force was unreasonable and violates the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. This is the mother of the young man who was involved in this horrific incident. He is killed during the course of this horrific event. A unanimous 3-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, again, that Fifth Circuit, ruled last year in favor of the officer on what it said was a narrow question. Patrick Higginbotham says this. He says, we may only ask under this particular rubric, under this very narrow moment of threat doctrine, whether Officer Felix was in danger at the moment of the threat that caused him to use the deadly force against Barnes. That's what Patrick Higginbotham, one of the judges on the panel in the Fifth Circuit, wrote. He added a concurring opinion, however, And this is significant because it gets to the Supreme Court on this basis. He said, had he been allowed to consider all the circumstances surrounding the stop, he could have ruled the other way and gone beyond this moment of threat doctrine to permit a trier of fact to assess everything. The judge instead said, given the rapid sequence of events and Officer Felix's role in drawing his weapon and jumping on the running board, the totality of the circumstances merits finding that Officer Felix violated Barnes' Fourth Amendment right to be free from excessive force. But under the rubric, this particular rubric as to police shootings, the moment of threat doctrine required to go in the opposite direction. At this recent argument, the case is called Barnes versus Felix. Some justices expressed concerns about second-guessing the police officer's split-second judgments. That is always a legitimate concern. Brett Kavanaugh said, an officer does not get the time we've spent here today to make that decision. And indeed, officers are required, as we all know, to make these split-second decisions, sometimes catastrophic in nature. But most of the justices on the Supreme Court seemed inclined to allow the court to consider more than the seconds before the shooting, adopting what Judge Higginbotham encouraged them to do, a broader understanding of the law. Sam Alito said this, would you be satisfied with a narrow holding that is wrong for a court to look just at the moment of the threat? The lawyer said he would, and he said, though he added, it would be helpful if the court makes clear that means that you can look at the jump in addition to the shoot. A lawyer for Officer Felix said the court should narrow its focus to the moment he used force. And that lawyer arguing he was clinging to the side of a fleeing suspect's car, and Felix reasonably believed that his life was in imminent danger. That conclusion, the lawyer for Officer Felix said, should end the case. In rebuttal, again, the lawyer on the other side said, you have to look at the whole picture, and here, that's more than just 2 seconds. The case arose, again, from this commonplace occurrence, a routine traffic stop in America, again, ending in the death of an unarmed black man in this case. The questions for the justices now, how closely should courts consider and confine this analysis to the moment of truth rather than the larger context? It appeared the Supreme Court seemed ready to reject that limit on these excessive force Fourth Amendment suits. There was something of a consensus that that theory was now too narrowly focused in the seconds preceding this shooting. And indeed, Neil Gorsuch says, everybody agrees it's wrong. What's the harm of saying that? And the question now, which we'll wait for in June, maybe May, maybe June, maybe July, is, what is it that this standard, what the standard, how is this going to look like? What is this, the Supreme Court going to tell us now is the standard? If it's not the moment of threat, what is the more expansive nature of the analysis that should, in fact, be applied in these kinds of minute-type decisions, these instances where tragedy happens when we have confrontations between law enforcement officers and citizens in America? That case, once again, going to tell us much about that. Barnes versus Felix, as the Supreme Court decides that case and many others on its 65 docket caseload in May and June. More about the Supreme Court as Amicus Law Review continues.
This is the Civic Media Radio Network. Locally grown radio, WFHR.
CBS News Brief. Here we go. A trade war's begun between the U.S. and Canada. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau.
Canada will be responding to the U.S. trade action with 25% tariffs against $155 billion worth of American goods.
In response to President Trump imposing 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico, whose president has ordered her economy minister to retaliate. Gas Buddies' Patrick DeHaan says the tariffs could affect gasoline prices in the U.S., starting in four regions.
The Great Lakes, the Rockies, the Midwest for crude oil tariffs, and the Northeast for tariffs on refined products.
Israeli-American Keith Siegel was among the three hostages released this weekend by Hamas in exchange for 183 Palestinian prisoners. His niece, Tal Wax.
You can see that Keith has been for 484 days in captivity. He's lost a lot of weight.
CBS News Brief. I'm Christopher Cruz.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
A blockbuster trade shakes up the NBA. Hi, I'm Jimmy Cusco with Civic Media Sports. The NBA was rocked by a major trade last night as the Los Angeles Lakers swapped Anthony Davis for Luka Doncic of the Dallas Mavericks in a three-team, seven-player deal. It's the first time that a midseason trade has included two players named All-NBA in the previous season. Tonight, the Milwaukee Bucks will try to avoid their third straight loss as they take on the Memphis Grizzlies. The Bucks have now fallen to fifth place in the Eastern Conference. Tip time is at 7:30. College hoops, it was the Wisconsin Badgers rallying in the second half to take down Northwestern 75-69 yesterday. John Tonjay led the 17th-ranked Badgers with 27 points in the win, which puts Wisconsin in a three-way tie for fourth place in the Big Ten. Wisconsin will get Indiana on Tuesday night in Madison. Then it was a top 25 showdown in Milwaukee last night on National Marquette Day. 9th-ranked Marquette never led against number 25 UConn, with UConn leading by as many as 22 points in a 77-69 win. Cam Jones had 22 points for Marquette, which will play at St. John's on Tuesday. For Civic Media Sports, I'm Jimmy Cusca.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price of light snow and flurries early. Otherwise, our skies will eventually turn partly cloudy with highs in the mid-40s. A west wind will develop. Snow moves back into the picture tonight, 1 to 2, perhaps 3 inches by dawn. Lows in the mid-20s, currently 35 degrees.
You know that tune. You're a star. You know stuff. Why not win stuff? Maybe it's stuff about TV or movies, but still, you shine at useless information. And WFHR and Culver's want to reward you.
Welcome back.
Join the morning show Fridays for a chance to win one value basket and a kid's meal. Be our next superstar with Culver's Star of the Day every Friday at 97.5 FM WFHR.
The Badgers.
Beats Max, fakes the three, takes the three, left side, yes sir.
Play.
Pivots, fades, flips, good again. Just outside the left elbow.
Here.
Goes up, got it, with the right hand, it counts at a foul.
This is your radio home for Wisconsin Badger basketball.
Brought to you by 8th Street Auto, Econ Electric, and Johnson & Sons Chrysler Jeep. Listen on 97.5 FM, 1320 AM WFHR, streaming live on the Civic Media app.
Hello there, this is James,
Melissa,
Chad,
and Seth, inviting you to come work with us. Civic Media is looking for a full-time sales professional to work with existing and new broadcast and digital media clients.
We're a fast-growing company that offers competitive wages, benefits, a relaxed working environment that focuses on quality of life, and includes a team of support to reach our shared goals.
Join us in continuing what we have done for 80 years. Be a part of the community, put into the community, celebrate community.
Find out more by contacting Chuck Gennaro at 715-935-8030 or email chuck.gennaro@civicmedia.us. All inquiries are confidential. Civic Media Incorporated is an equal opportunity employer, and we look forward to you joining us.
Fear you're missing out when you miss our conversations on air? You can always join the discussion on our social media channels. Find Civic Media on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can also find social media for specific shows and hosts on our website. Go to civicmedia.us.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, Emily Zifos is back as my guest co-host. We're going to talk about Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Brian Hagedorn recusing himself from an Act 10 lawsuit. What does that mean? Join us.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this second hour of our weekend broadcast on law, and in particular the United States Supreme Court. We know that in addition to those oral arguments that have followed the inauguration of our president on January 21 and January 22nd, the Supreme Court has also got more oral arguments scheduled in many other cases coming up in February and March. We know that there are four oral arguments between February 24th, 25th, and 26th. Four more oral arguments between March 3rd and 5th. Lots of things going on in the Supreme Court. You can listen in on those oral arguments as they happen, and you can also pull up the recorded oral arguments for your review, for your assessment. You can hear the justices themselves talk about these cases. You can hear the things that I quote to you in this broadcast as they come out of the mouths of the justices, including Neil Gorsuch and including Sam Alito and others on the bench. All of that, again, going to be a part of our continuing analysis of our Supreme Court. Along the way, from time to time, as you know well, the Supreme Court also does other things. It decides to take or not take certain cases, and thereby determining whether or not they can, the laws that are challenged, the actions that are challenged, continue to stand. If the Supreme Court takes a case, it may well signal that they're going to return with decisions that may reverse a lower court. It may reverse an action by the executive branch or another portion of government. But if the Supreme Court decides not to take a case or decides to do something without providing reasons, that also has an impact upon the way that we understand the law in America. So let's talk about something else that sounds very wonky and very lawyerish. And it is indeed a thing called the Corporate Transparency Act of 2021. Supreme Court recently, just this past week or so, revived this federal law. What does it do? It requires companies to report information about their owners in an effort to combat things like money laundering, the drug trade, and terrorism. The Supreme Court basically revives this law that's meant to fight money laundering after some lower court actions, which I'll describe now. The court's brief order, no reasons at all, typical when the justices act on these emergency applications. This is sometimes called their shadow docket. Once again, we don't get reasoned opinions as we do in those many cases coming out in May and June, where we've got tomes of things written by the concurring justices and dissenting justices. Here, the ruling without any particular reasons, but nonetheless upholding and reviving a law that is meant to fight money laundering, among other things. The ruling is what's called provisional. It reinstates the law while a challenge to it at the lower courts move forward. Critics of the Corporate Transparency Act of 2021, and this is where this all comes about, say it's needlessly burdensome. And by virtue of what it requires in under the law, it's a threat to privacy and an unconstitutional federal intrusion, they say, on matters that have been historically regulated by the states. This is a state interest, they say, not the federal government. You're way overreaching here. Congress shouldn't do this. No authority to pass this kind of legislation. The challenge to the law brought by a firearms dealer, a technology company, a dairy, and the Libertarian Party of Mississippi, also the National Federation of Independent Businesses, which was the lead plaintiff in the first major challenge to the Affordable Care Act as well. In that case, you may recall the plaintiffs in the challenge to the transparency law argued that the Constitution's Commerce Clause did not authorize Congress to regulate what they said was inaction rather than an economic activity. So a lot of these issues, once again, being revisited in this challenge to the law. The challengers here noting the law covers tens of millions of very small businesses, small entities out there, including homeowners associations and family trusts. They said that complying with the law will collectively cost tens of billions of dollars. We can't suffer that, they said. And in addition, it's way beyond the capacity of Congress to act. And again, consistent with how they've argued before, Supreme Court, they said, should strike this down. At a lower court, the Federal District Court in Texas, a judge named Amos Mazzant, M-A-Z-Z-A-N-T, he blocked the law nationwide, saying that Congress had overstepped its constitutional authority. Though seemingly benign, he said, this federal mandate marks a drastic twofold departure from history. First, he said it represents a federal attempt to monitor companies created under state law.
a matter that our federalist system has left almost exclusively to the several states. He's buying into that states' rights theory. And second, he said the CTA, again, the law here, the Consumer Corporate Transparency Act, the CTA ends a feature of corporate formation as designed by those various states. Again, using that concept. And that concept is anonymity. He said, for good reason, plaintiffs fear this flanking quasi-Orwellian statute and its implications on our dual system of government. The lower court judge, the federal district court judge in Texas, blocking the law, saying it cannot be enforced. A three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals, here we come, for the Fifth Circuit, temporarily lifted that injunction, observing, and they said, this three-judge panel, the ownership and operation of a business are economic activities. A reporting requirement for entities engaged in these economic activities falls within a century of the Supreme Court's Commerce Clause jurisprudence. Nothing wrong with this at all. That's the first three-judge panel. It was divided. And a different three-judge panel of the Fifth Circuit later reverses course, and it blocks the law while the appeal moves forward. Arguments for the Fifth Circuit are scheduled for late March. Following all of that, it's a lot. Once again, it's a lot to consume. You've got judges there, lower court judges, district court judges, appellate court judges, going in opposite directions on this legitimate issue about whether or not Congress, in its economic activity rubric, can in fact pass this kind of legislation, or whether or not it's so burdensome and invades the anonymity, as the lower court judge said, that it is indeed Orwellian in nature and therefore should be stricken down. So what does the Supreme Court do just recently? The Supreme Court basically says the law can continue to be in effect while the lower courts, including the Fifth Circuit, continues to argue about all of this. A major argument coming up again in March about this. But in the meantime, the Corporate Transparency Act, again, blocked by a federal judge. Supreme Court reviving that federal law, requiring companies to report this information about their owners to combat money laundering and other things like terrorism and drugs out there. Again, the limited order here, without any reasons, without clear statements, a part of the docket of the Supreme Court when they review these kinds of things on emergency applications changes the law, right? It changes the way that the law will be applied. Right now, the Corporate Transparency Act is still alive, awaiting further oral argument in the Fifth Circuit, certainly going to be returning to the Supreme Court ultimately one day to decide this contested issue. Reasonable people on both sides saying you can't do this. Supreme Court obviously determining for now that they want to hear more from the lower courts before deciding on what to do here. Also a part of the work and the mission of our Supreme Court. Again, we live in a nation where not only can and do reasonable litigants disagree, but they've got this amazing opportunity to petition to our highest courts, including circuit courts, yes, including the Fifth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit and the Seventh Circuit and the Second Circuit and all the courts around our country. And indeed, they can also seek review, if not obtain review, by the United States Supreme Court. They can ask the court to review the lower court decisions. The Supreme Court plainly cannot, does not take all of the appeals sent to it, and therefore does what is called denying that writ of certiorari as to many people who are dissatisfied with lower court judgments. Here, likely the Supreme Court will take this one up, grant a writ of certiorari after the Fifth Circuit is completely done with it. In this instance, telling the lower court, you entertain your oral argument, you go ahead and do this. In the meantime, the law stays in effect for not only Texas, not only the Fifth Circuit, for all the rest of us who are responsible for abiding by the law of the United States of America. We've talked a lot about that in recent days, recent times, when we invoke once again the requirement of our Constitution that says that the President of the United States of America has got to take care that the laws of our nation be faithfully executed. That language being used more and more by federal district court and presumably one day appellate court judges in addressing many of the kinds of things that the Trump administration is doing these days, not only in connection with financial programs, federal funding programs, a judge, again, stopping that from happening. Ultimately, maybe the White House rescinding those bans on the expenditure of federal monies for all kinds of programs. programs out there. Still a little bit murky in terms of what the White House has and has not done. Another court, as we know well, a district court in Washington, saying that the approach of the president when it comes to birthright citizenship, that first sentence of the 14th Amendment, that can stand. He says it's undeniably unconstitutional what the president has done. And all of that invoking this notion that the president is required to abide by the law as established by the Congress, as, yes, executed by the executive branch, but nonetheless following the law, taking care that the laws of our nation be faithfully executed. All of that going on inside the rubric, inside the standards of our United States Supreme Court. We know as well that there are other things going on in the federal courts of America. We're going to talk about more of that right now. We have talked in the past about the role of the Department of Justice in a bipartisan, a nonpartisan, apolitical way of charging and, yes, seeking the convictions of people regardless of their partisan views, their political affiliations. We know that under the Biden administration, for example, there was a prosecution of the president's own son on gun charges, on tax charges. Now, as the president's son was convicted and then facing sentencing, we know well that the president, the former president, also pardoned his son. Lots of controversy about that. Lots of controversy about all the pardons issued by Joe Biden and by Donald Trump in recent days. And we've talked about a lot of the merits and demerits of the use of that pardon power. But we know that all of that comes in the wake of a Department of Justice that should be apolitical, that should be premised upon what the facts of cases show and what grand juries and what investigations lead to in terms of charges against individuals. We know that in the prior administration, that a person named Robert Menendez, the New Jersey's former senator, was charged by this process under the Biden administration Department of Justice by a grand jury convened again by the courts, the grand jury, of course, an entity of the United States court. Robert Menendez charged with violations of federal law. Robert Menendez, a Democrat, a powerful longtime senator, convicted last year on federal bribery and corruption charges. We know that well. We know exactly what this was all about and the nature of the charges presented in a federal court in Manhattan. The course of that trial, again, indicted 16 months ago while Menendez was serving as the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, one of the most powerful perches in Washington, D.C. As a result of all of that prosecution, the prosecution against Menendez, ultimately Menendez found guilty of those federal bribery and corruption charges. And just recently, Robert Menendez, as a part of our process in our federal system, afforded to everyone, every defendant, including Robert Menendez, including Donald Trump, in a different setting, a different court, that court in Manhattan 3 weeks ago, Robert Menendez appearing in a courtroom, a federal courtroom also in Manhattan, to receive his sentence imposed by Judge Sidney Stein. He's a federal district court judge there in the Southern District of New York, for the violations of law for which he was convicted. And that process, again, is something that every defendant in America is exposed to as a part of our routine process of the administration of justice. We can comment about this. We can disagree about these kinds of things. But we all need to embrace the notion that our system is premised upon this kind of process. And as Amicus Law Review continues, we want to tell you about what Sidney Stein, the federal district court judge, said in that sentencing of Robert Menendez, also a part of the rule of law in our nation. And then we'll also talk about another aspect of the rule of law having to do with yet another character in our national history, our national recency, named Rudy Giuliani. All of that as Amicus Law Review continues. We'll be right back.
You're listening to locally grown radio, WFHR.
Hey, it's me time at Chula Vista. Time for you to pamper yourself. Wisconsin's most complete resort experience has everything you want. Fine-tuned for 70 years by four generations of the Kaminsky family, Chula Vista can be easygoing with colorful scenic river walks, 18 holes of classic golf, a relaxing spa, or you can go all out in 80,000 square feet of indoor water park. Ziplining through canyon views in Chula's Aerial Adventure Park. And dining comes any way you like it, from pizza to Wisconsin's number one ranked steakhouse. More than 600 guest rooms to choose from with $10 million in updates. Chula Vista, everything you've been wanting, all right here on site. Check it out at ChulaVistaResort.com.
USA Today's Reader's Choice Awards named Chula Vista one of America's top 10 indoor water parks. Find out why at ChulaVistaResort.com.
This is locally grown radio, WFHR.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. This is our final segment of this two-hour program, talking now about two cases in which the federal system works. Regardless of how you think about the results of the justice system with respect to Robert Menendez and Rudy Giuliani, appropriate for all of us under our First Amendment to be able to talk about these things in public. That's one of the other joys and delights and honors of our nation, where we can talk and even disagree about these things, but all embracing the notion that there is a process. And that process includes a trial in which you are presumed innocent until a jury finds you guilty, if at all. And then after that, a sentencing that's conducted by a federal district court judge or a state district court judge, a trial court judge, presumably, who has heard the evidence and can impose a just sentence. At the trial of Robert Menendez, you may recall, jurors were told how Menendez secretly drafted a letter on behalf of Egyptian officials who were hoping for millions more in military aid from the United States, shared some sensitive details about U.S. embassy personnel in Cairo, also attempted to interfere with state and federal criminal prosecutions in New Jersey on behalf of various allies. An extraordinary trial. In the end, the federal district court judge just this past week imposing an 11-year sentence, an 11-year federal sentence upon former Senator Robert Menendez. The judge saying this, he says, "You were successful and powerful." And before announcing the penalty, the judge went on to say, "You stood at the apex of our political system. Somewhere along the way, I don't know where it was," this is the judge speaking, "you lost your way. Working for the public good became working for your good, your good." That's what Judge Sidney Stein said as a result of this. During the course of the proceeding, former Senator Menendez was there with his sister, both of his children, sitting directly behind him. As the sentencing concluded, of course, he lingered somewhat in the courtroom. He grasped the knees, on one knee on a chair, and as he grasped his children's hand, then he headed out to address a crowd of reporters. And in the public arena, he was not nearly as chastened as he was appearing in front of the judge. When Robert Menendez was speaking directly to the judge as a part of this process, his right of allocution, he described himself as a chastened man who had suffered the ignominy of a guilty verdict and the resignation of a Senate seat. He said, "Every day I'm awake as a punishment. I ask," he said, "you to temper your sort of justice and mercy for a lifetime of duty." And it was after that, of course, the judge imposed this 11-year sentence. Publicly, the senator, after embracing his children in the courtroom, went out into the public and offered a scathing indictment of the justice system and what appeared to be a direct appeal to, yes, President Trump, who has the power to pardon him. The president has given no indication, of course, that he would entertain that pardon for former Senator Menendez. But Menendez said this publicly. Let me just say this. He said this whole process has been nothing but a political witch hunt. He said, "President Trump is right. This process is political and it's corrupted to the core. I hope President Trump cleans up the cesspool and restores the integrity of the system." Again, Daniel Sassoon, whose name we heard before earlier in this broadcast, said in a statement that the sentencings of Menendez and two of the co-defendants
send a clear message about justice. He said they sent a clear message that attempts at any level of government to corrupt the nation's foreign policy and the rule of law will be met with just punishment. Lots and lots of debate in the wake of this, in the midst of this, about what happened to Bob Menendez. At a minimum, the need to embrace the process that resulted in a very strong sentence, 11 years in federal prison for this violation of the public trust, and a process coming to its conclusion or its near conclusion, because again, Robert Menendez is going to appeal this. He has already indicated he's going to appeal this. In the meantime, the court has allowed Menendez to remain free on bond pending that appeal. He also delayed the start of the sentence until early June so that he could attend the trial of his wife, which you may recall is also facing like charges in all of this. Lots of procedural history yet to come. Menendez not yet surrendering that for that term of imprisonment because of his interest in appealing, as he is right to do under our system, to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. Arguably, one day perhaps reaching the Supreme Court, unlikely they would grant certiorari in that case, but all of those avenues in our system open to a defendant now sentenced and exercising his right to appeal that judgment to a higher court. In another court, Rudy Giuliani, the former mayor of New York, grilled for hours in federal court after missing several deadlines and handing over $11 million of his prized possession to those two poll workers who he defamed after the 2020 election. He previously avoided being held in contempt of court, but recently Giuliani settled all of this. He keeps some of his property in settlement of that defamation case, an agreement allowing the former mayor of New York City to keep his apartments and some other valuables that were subject of all of this dispute in return for an undisclosed payment to those two election workers who he defamed after the 2020 election. He reached this settlement with those two Georgia election workers. We may recall that he repeatedly defamed them by saying that they compromised the votes in Georgia. The former mayor, as a result of that, found civilly liable for defaming the two of them. He was at risk of losing millions of dollars worth of personal mementos, valuables, real estate that he had gathered over his decades practicing law and then in public office. He had previously been ordered to pay down about $11 million of, yes, that's right, the $148 million judgment he owed the election workers, their names, Ruby Friedman and Shay Moss, a part of the history of this litigation. Good for them in not only enforcing this judgment, ultimately settling it for an undisclosed amount. That is also a part of our system of justice in America. Join us again next weekend as we continue to address things in the courts of America, in the halls of justice in America, here on Amicus Law Review and the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Have a good weekend, everybody.
Locally grown radio, WFHR. Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome Wisconsin-based comedian Eli Pills and Nightlight frequent flyer, musician, producer, and founder of Wisconsinology.com, Frank Anderson. We're going to light it up.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 6 till 8.
Are you ever questioning when life will slow down? Are you ever thinking of just relaxing and enjoying the simple things? All of this is possible, even while still being in the workforce. Worthington, Minnesota is a town growing, yet it's nothing like metro life. Professional and labor jobs, a beautiful lake, bike trails, recreation, acres of public hunting, festivals, and great people. Slow down. We're just a short drive away. So come join us. Worthington, it's worth a look.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app. This is locally grown radio. WFHR 1320 AM. W248 DE Wisconsin Rapids. And always streaming on the Civic Media app. Matt Nair on air.
Dan Schaefer, Civic Media's political editor.
No court in the country came closer to overturning the 2020 election results than the conservative majority on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And we have Brad Schimmel, who's been siding with January 6th rioters. So if you want your vote to count going forward, show up and vote on April 1st. Let's channel that energy into the Wisconsin Supreme Court race.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
That first time seeing my son, I feel like my life did a 180. He really a definition of like why he loves somebody.
Through all of fatherhood's firsts, never stop being a dad. Visit fatherhood.gov to hear more. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Christopher Cruz. It's a tit-for-tat over tariffs between the U.S. and our northern and southern neighbors.
The tariffs are 10% against Chinese goods and 25% against goods from Mexico and Canada. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says his country will not sit idly by.
Canada will be responding to the U.S. trade action with 25% tariffs against $155 billion. Worth of American goods.
The prime minister said for starters, those goods would include Florida orange juice, Tennessee whiskey, and Kentucky peanut butter. Linda Kenyon, CBS News, Washington.
The U.S. tariffs are set to take effect on Tuesday. Why is President Trump targeting Canada with tariffs? On NBC Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem.
We still know we're extremely vulnerable across that northern border, that we have people coming into our country from China, from foreign